Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
All right. Hello. Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I'm your host, Jason Napolitano, and I have co-host Chris Sheridan on the line. How are you doing today, Chris?
Doing great, Jason. Great to be here.
I'm excited about today's show. Chris is actually gonna take the wheel on this one. We're doing a special edition of the show on the Secret Teachings of All Ages, Manly Hall's excellent book, subtitled An Encyclopedic Outline of Masonic, Hermetic, Kabbalistic, and Rosicrucian Symbolical Philosophy. And we are doing this because May 28th is the anniversary of this special and most esteemed book, May 28th. It's in the preface. At the beginning of the book, Manly Hall makes some comments about the book and so on, and that date is given. So we are using that as our anniversary celebration for this fantastic book. I'm going to do a little invocation. This is off of a statue of an Egyptian initiate done by Claire Pierpont. Is that correct? Claire Pierpont, right? Claire Pierpont. And she was one of the supporters of the PRS, and an artist who Manly Hall was acquainted with, and she was a follower of his work, and donated many important artworks to the PRS subsequently. This is off of the statue of this Egyptian initiate. It's in the courtyard of the PRS near the auditorium, and it says on the back, and this is the invocation for today: Thou sun who has covered the truth with thy golden disc, do thou remove the veil so that I may see the truth within thee and know the meaning of thy rays of glory. For the truth that is within thee is within me, and I am that. And then on the statue, it actually says, thou art that, tat tvam asi. It doesn't say tat tvam asi, but that's a Vedantic statement, thou art that. And without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to you, Chris, and lead us to some Manly Hall and Secret Teachings wisdom.
All right. Well, thanks for that opening invocation. It's I've probably seen that 1,000 times or more going in there. And every time I stop and just, always take a look at that or consider that. So, yes, we are going to discuss primarily, actually specifically, the Secret Teachings of All Ages. This book has been in continuous publication now for 91 years as of May 28th, and has gone through several editions and reprints, different sizes and prices throughout the years. And it has endured to this day. The Masonic Hall in Washington, D.C. Counts it, and they've tweeted about this, it counts it as their number one requested most interested book in their large collection in library. Yes, so it's relevant today. There's a whole new generation getting interested in it. There's a reader's edition copy that is available at bookstores. It's not huge. You can actually lug it around with you.
Yeah.
And it's got a great index and you can look it up. And so there's a PDF version of it somewhere, I think. And it's online. It's sacred text. So it has, again, morphed into this current technological, media landscape that we have. But the ideas and the content within the pages or text is quite ancient. It goes way back, and so far that the origins and actual true natures of a lot of the mystery traditions really are unknown. So these fragments, have been brought back, and it is an encyclopedia. This current Tarcher, I think, Penguin version of it that you can get at Borders and Barnes and Nobles, it's called the Reader's Edition, but it's kind of not a reader book like you would read a novel or a nonfiction thing.
Yeah.
Manly Hall makes no mistake about it. It is an encyclopedia. Now, it's put in a form, the text is, that you can actually read it. There's sentences and not just bullet points. So there is a narrative, as if from a narrator or storyteller, but it really is an encyclopedia, and it needs to be seen as that. And I think we'll, as we go through our talk today, we'll see just how that is and why it is that we need to look at it that way. And the book itself really had quite a journey to just to come into being, from the initial idea to when the initial set of subscribers editions were out. And it's just as almost interesting as the journey that it's taken since. So I guess for this talk today, we can maybe break it down into a few parts. We're going to talk about the journey of the book coming into being, and let's really talk about the book without getting into too much detail about any particular entry.
Okay.
Really just look at the structure of the book, you know, what it is and almost why it is too, and how to approach it.
Yeah.
And then we'll look at, you know, this more contemporary, okay, what does it do for me now? Like you and me now in this time frame where we are 91 years after its publication, why is it still relevant? And if so, how? So the journey of the book, started with, you know, they say a journey of 10,000 miles starts with a single step. This book started with a journey of 38,000 miles. And in late 1923, when Mr. Hall was 22, he announced that he was setting out on a world tour to Japan, to the Forbidden City in China, to places in the Near East, to places at that time, 100 years ago, it were really difficult to get to, even travel itself. You were on a steamer, and we didn't really, you know, it was very much a challenge and an expense, and quite a journey. And it took him about 9 months to make this world tour. And of course, he stopped in London and spent several weeks at the British Museum.
So let me jump in real quick just to contextualize this for people who are not too familiar with Manly Hall. At this point, he has not started the PRS. He's speaking out, but pretty infrequently out in Los Angeles. Was he in Los Angeles by this time? He was, right?
Yeah, from 1919 on, he started speaking at the Church of the People in Santa Monica. And very shortly, he took over from the aged leader of that church. But it was a very metaphysical, very new age. It was such a huge movement in Los Angeles from the late 1800s to, you know, the, you know, 20s, 30s. And then, of course, again, in the 60s, it also became a mecca for exploring alternate consciousness and
even today,
different traditions.
It remains so today.
And it is again today. And that's how they go in cycles. And I think we're really on
a new
and for the same reasons. That we've lost our way. We've been stuck in this material.
Sure.
And we need to get back on track. We need to reacquaint ourselves with these ancient symbols.
Exactly.
And what they mean to us, and be able to talk and speak that language of symbolic philosophy and mythology.
And so, speaking of that, that was one of the main reasons he set out to do this book in the first place. Is that correct?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And this type of a book had been published before, in a sense. There was the Anacalypsis in, I think, the 1830s. And there was Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine. By Madame Blavatsky in the later 1800s. And in all three cases, these were two-volume books, very, very lengthy, probably 1,000 pages when you put them all together. And it is a comparative religion, a gathering, an anthology of a lot of different traditions that were very obscure and compiled together. And he references those works and many more in The Secret Teachings. And initially, when he announced this trip to go around the world to gather material and experience firsthand some of these cultures. He didn't want to just do it from a from behind a desk or stuck in a library somewhere. Mm-hmm. And he went to the pyramids. He went to the Forbidden City. He went to Jerusalem in 1924. So he put himself there. So there was at least some level of walking some of those footsteps, sure, as he's gathering this together. That was a very important. And that was the beginning of it. Before he wrote a word, he took this trip and took notes. But he initially announced that it was going to be a two-volume work. Then there was another announcement that it was going to be this two-volume book, and he was going to also offer a more graphical set of symbolic prints and images. There was more like a picture book. I think what happened sometime in the process, he realized he could merge all these together. So it is very much a visual book.
Yeah.
There are color plates back when color printing wasn't really, it was very expensive and very difficult, and not a lot of people did it.
And all of those color plates were all done by J. Augustus Knapp, correct? And had him do those original pieces of artwork specifically for the book, right?
They were definitely commissioned. They had worked before on the Lost Keys of Freemasonry in, I think, 1923. Mm. And Knapp was very familiar in Masonic circles because he did the illustrations for John Neary Lloyd's Edda Dorfa book.
Oh, very good. Okay.
And that was in the late 1800s. So he was definitely somebody, he was the kind of the go-to guy. And after the secret teachings, Hall and Knapp developed and printed a tarot card deck to get the Knapp Hall tarot card deck.
Which so is, yeah, that's a great deck.
It's been reprinted. You can actually get it. It's available now.
That's a fantastic deck.
So there was a long time, you know, there was and such a common interest in this type of material. And although this is somewhat speculative, I can't help but think there is also a common concern for the need to gather this material again and put it out. So really, for this first time, he was at a crossroads, an opportunity of old world bookmaking, where the artisans, and he went to great lengths to choose the exact paper and the
particular
printer
and
the ink,
yeah.
And these, you know, this, you had to use, you know, copper and zinc, you know, processing to make these color plates. And it was, and again, it was expensive. You know, I think $100,000 was put into it.
Yeah, I remember reading that, which I wanted to kind of contextualize that for people today. I mean, this is 1920, when he's doing this, 22, 23,
25, 26, okay, you know, in that area. When
so $100,000, I mean, was like $1 million today or more, right? I mean, is
it was quite expensive.
That's
and the book only sold for $100. So.
And mind you, he also, this was an interesting thing I read in one of these side articles that we were looking at this week in preparation for the show, that he's at this time, he didn't have a cent. I mean, to put this book together, he's not a wealthy person. He's not from a background of prestige and power. And so this endeavor was really a speculative sort of a venture for him. I mean, he had to raise the funds. He had to put the people together. I mean, it was like almost like he was a producer of an independent film or something. I mean, he's putting together artists, like you said. And
well, a pre-sale, right? Is a term that
sure. You
use to make a film.
Certainly.
Where you sell broadcasting or
exactly.
Printing rights, exhibition rights before the film is shot. So he had sold 1,200 copies, I believe at $75, the pre-sale price. It then went up to $100 for the retail price, but these pre-sales were $75. And before the first one rolled off the printing press.
Yeah.
So there was great demand. He was a known person by then.
Well, he had written Lost Keys, right? He had written Initiates mm-hmm. of the Flame, and he had written these, what was it, the Wands and Serpents? Is that the other one?
Yeah, that was one of his first. Some of those were smaller pamphlet size. He had reprinted many lectures. He had been speaking nonstop, and he had
a good following by that time.
And it was, you know, we're talking the 20s.
Yeah.
There was, you know, it was kind of a prosperous time.
Sure, sure. This is prior to the Great Depression. So that's what people need to.
It is. This is prior to the crash. And that played a factor.
It does play a factor later, doesn't it?
It most certainly does, and it's reflected in the work. But at this time, so no expense was spared because you could do that. And also, he being kind of an old man in a young man's body, being in his mid-20s, he had such a breadth and depth and love and just uncanny way of speaking and having such a vast knowledge about the ancient mysteries. At that time, it was, I'm not saying it was a dying art or craft, but there weren't too many young people doing it that were not these kind of New Age charlatans, mm-hmm. or New Thought, or there was everything else.
Sure, fakes. He talks about that, the fake swamis and the prosperity consciousness preachers and all these sort of fly by night charlatans that were dominating the scene at the time.
And Hall had this undeniable authenticity. He didn't try to. He never had a doctrine or tried to sell a cult thing. He had a nonprofit organization that he raised funds for and asked for donations. But it was never about being a Hallite, or something like that. He was all about the ancient wisdom, and of course he was the face of the whole thing. But it wasn't about a cult of personality or anything like that with him. So people knew at the time, and he had a couple of benefactors, and then taking over this church from this Raymond Blight, who the Church of the People, of course, it had its own following. And here's this young guy who's dynamic and very, very, he's very grown up as a young man. And he knew this information and was able to express it in such a way that people could connect with it. And so all the followers, in this church were like, oh my gosh, here's this guy that can really do something. And books were getting bankrolled. Hemingway, his first two books were funded by people, not a publisher, not because he was popular, but he got some benefactors that believed in him. So, this kind of thing happened, and I'm sure it happens today, but it's interesting how he took this on. And although it took, about 5 years between the time he ventured off on this journey, which is also published in a book called 38,000 Miles of Impressions. And he would write letters back, and then he kind of summed things up at the end about this journey that he took and some pictures as he was in meeting firsthand these cultures at a time when that was not very common. Also, Madame Blavatsky, whom he greatly admired, had traveled in Nepal and sometimes dressing as a man so she could gain entry into places that were just, it was just difficult to travel anywhere.
Yeah, just in general.
But then to be able to get into these places. Sure. But that was, so this book really begins with an adventure, which I think is really neat. And of course, then the book itself
now,
is taken
that a book
on its own.
Is that 38,000 Miles book, is that something that's on Amazon that people can find?
I think it's out
of
print.
Is it
out
of print?
Right now, there may be some reprinters
floating around,
a PDF on archive.org.
Okay.
To find an original, because it was printed, finally published in 1925.
Okay.
They rarely come up. But that might be one to talk about. We could,
down the road, let's do that.
Reprints or something,
exactly.
and get involved with that.
For sure.
So, because he's very multicultural, very much believed in that the equality of different cultures and nations and races and people, he even wrote an essay on race relations following that trip.
And that's so very early. I mean, that is 40 something, 50 years before, at least 40 years before civil rights movement in the U.S. So it's at a time of
absolutely
of challenge, certainly in the country. So he was,
and the solution was the same, or the influence, or let's say the wisdom you use to approach these things is the same as it was then, as it is now. And that's partially what he tried to encapsulate in this book, The Secret Teachings. is this body of knowledge and the correct use of it, which involves using your own consciousness, and we're almost at that point to talk about it becomes then the solution. It's like a universal solution to almost any particular problem, because it's the approach and it's the you, the enlightened you, who approaches these things that makes the difference, that finds solution.
Hey, before I forget, I want to let the listeners know of this, the great article that you sent over to me from the PRS Journal. It's from autumn of 1970. And there's an article called The Great Book. And it is a wonderful recollection of all the things we're talking about and more, written by Harold B.B. Voorhees, who was a member of the Rosicrucian Order, the Supreme Magus of the Rosicrucian Order at the time. And that is available at manlyhall.info. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it's manlyphall.info.
Sorry.
That's a great resource. That's one of the best resources.
Yeah, we've referenced that many times, and every time I forget the URL for it. So thank you for keeping me honest. Okay, so let's do this.
So let me just wrap up about the book, and then let's get into, really what is the book and how to approach it.
Absolutely.
I believe it was 2,400 copies initially printed. About the in 1928 and 29, this very, very large, the very nice gilt edges and thick paper from the Nash Publishing Company of the Secret Teachings, eventually sold out. And then the stock market crashed, and we have this depression in the 30s.
So, 1920, so May 28, 1928, that's the book is dated as that. Then in 1929, October of 1929, I believe, is when the stock market crash was. And then the depression is 1929 plus up until about the beginning of World War II, just to put that in perspective for people. So there were actually, I'm looking at this, there were 2,200 copies of that original printing.
2,200.
So it's the subscribers edition at 550, King Solomon edition 550, Rosicrucian 100, Theosophical edition 200, and then the fifth edition, the last one, was 800 copies. Just to put that in perspective for people. So, sorry.
You can find an original 1928 version, one of those. Mm-hmm.
What do those go for?
Maybe 2,000 and up for one in good shape.
About $2,000?
They're probably going to be, start worth more and more as time goes on, especially if they're
in good condition,
very good shape. But what happened was, in after this, the Roaring Twenties and all this funding that was so easy to, it seemed like a lot easier to get, Hall never wanted that to be an obstacle for people to get to the wisdom. Yes, a $75 book, but now is hard for people. So it wasn't for everybody. No. But in 1936. He came out with a reduced size and black and white, I think it was a photostat facsimile reproduction of the Secret Teaching, still hardbound, and had everything that's in it, but it was just all printed in black and white, and sold it for $10.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
So here's this $100 book that 8 years earlier was selling out, like you wouldn't believe, and now here it is, $10. You can see it in the pamphlets that he printed out. There were gilt edges and illustrations and all this in the 20s with some of his books. And then in the 30s, it's like you just printed it off in a press in the back room with a one color kind of hard card paper cover, folded over and stapled, and he sold those for 15 cents. And he spoke at Carnegie Hall in the 40s. And, it's how it didn't really matter what the world was going through. He made sure that, and this book is a reflection of that. And it got republished and reprinted all through the, and became color again in the 70s. Mm-hmm. in 1975, he offered a color version again that came back. And I think that sold for $100. So there it was 50 years later. So
what it did in the 20s, yeah.
Back then. Yeah. So it sounds like a big book, an expensive book, but it's an investment in your wisdom and the wisdom of the world and the future of the civilization. And it's still about $100 or, you know, whatever you can find.
Or online. Like you said, so those reader's editions are very affordable. I mean, I think on Amazon, they go $15, $16 or something, or and used, yeah. I mean, they're, I'm sure even less. So, yeah.
No, and you can look, the text is available online.
For free.
Yeah. So it's, you know, the point is, you know, that's one journey is, I guess, the book and the text. And it seems obviously that it survived and will continue through its 100th year. And I'm sure beyond it's outlived its author. And but the wisdom in the pages hasn't outlived us. And what's in the pages, moving on, is this encyclopedia of wisdom traditions, mostly from the Western. There was not a lot on, you know, Taoism or Confucianism or anything, although he approached those subjects before and after all throughout his career. This one mainly deals with a broad range, anything from alchemy to American Indian symbolism, biblical, Masonic, all the mystery schools of the Greeks and the Chaldeans and
sure.
In Odin, the Nordic mysteries.
All of the secret societies, Rosicrucians,
the Egyptians,
Freemasonry. I mean, you name it. Atlantis, which we did a little piece on. Atlantis and one of our other shows. By the way, I'm going to make a quick plug for all of our other secret teachings podcasts. Go back and listen to those. They're all on sections of the book. And I think if you are excited about this book as we are, you will love those talks that we've done. So go and check those out. Sorry for interrupting you there.
All right. Okay. Well, so yes, it's an encyclopedia, and yes, it covers a broad range of mysterious images and ancient traditions. But in June 1928, just the month following its publication, he gave a couple lectures in San Francisco, and he dedicated parts of those lectures to the book itself. So this is presumably the release of the book, and he's telling us how to approach the book, or maybe how to look at it. So he says to look at it as a front door. Does not tell you very much, but it's a path leading to ancient wisdom. You'll find in it 45 chapters, all presumably different, and yet all exactly the same. The 45 chapters tell one story and repeat it again and again, each repeating it in a different way, each reaching a different type of mind. So yes, it seems like it's all over the map. And it's sometimes it's very hard to see the same story again, although there are some similarities that do pop out. You know, that's kind of the mystery of the book. And this really, this is the only place I've seen him that we know where he's articulated this.
I mean, how to actually approach this material.
How to actually approach it.
I consistently refer to this.
So this is very rare. Yeah. There's only, it's one document. And I don't know if, you know, probably a handful of people even know about it. And hopefully now more through the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
But I thought that was really interesting that, so maybe one of the ways to approach it is, you know, skim through it or whatever. But if one chapter of these 40 jumps out, well, maybe that's the one, at least now at this point in your journey, is resonating with your mind and your consciousness. So then maybe focus on that one and try to get into it. But he goes on to say that it's not what you are going to get by reading this book that will help you. It is what you will get if you will think about what you read.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a two-part process. Yes, you're going to read about it, but then what are you going to do about it? Or what? How does this affect you? And another approach, he goes on to say about the book, is that there are basically three ways that he presents the material, this symbolic philosophy of all these ancient wisdom traditions.
So and three specific ways in the book that this material is presented.
Okay. Yes. And one involves the color plates. There's a color plate, full-size color image, facing each new chapter. So there's 45 of those, plus there's some supplemental, a couple of them fold out. There's one at the introduction. So there's more than 45. I think there's 54 total of these color plates. That these are pictures, and they're very symbolic. There's a very famous one that gets used a lot of Pythagoras holding up a pyramid and his theorem sort of encrypted in some of the imagery.
I have that but on, this on is my wall, one, actually.
Yes,
I love that one.
And this is one level of entry of approaching this book, is approaching the ancient wisdom, is really just by looking at this color picture. And there's a caption that describes what goes on and explains some of the images. But just with that one image, or you could look at the whole book and look at all 50 color pictures as a picture book, and you're going to get something out of it. But it works on you in a different way. When you see, if you don't read the caption, you're just looking at the image. It's visual imagery. It's not literal text or representational words that point to, kind of narrow something down. This opens things
up. So that's
up.
More of a,
wow, what is
yeah,
this
that's
thing?
More of an intuitive or a symbolic approach. I'm reminded of the tarot cards, that those symbols on the cards, just looking at the cards is a sort of a meditation unto itself. And it's opening up a, archetypal part of yourself on a different level. It's not a rational sort of thinking mode. It's something quite different, isn't it?
Right. It is. I mean, you can look up in a book like, well, what does the Four of Clubs mean? And you'll get an interpretation, and that can be helpful if you're
sure,
studying it. But on another level, you could just kind of look
image,
at the pictures and take a guess.
Sure. Even beyond language, what's going on in
yes.
the unconscious? How is that affecting? We might not even know. On a rational level, we think, oh, this picture means this, this, and this. And then on a subtle level in the unconscious, the personal unconscious, it's actually affecting a completely different part of ourselves, and we don't even realize it. And that's the beauty of symbolism.
Well, it is, and it can mean something different to you than it does
exactly.
to me.
Exactly.
So it even has that really kind of a personal thing. So that's one approach or one level of the book. Then another level of the book is on every page, surrounded by text. And that's really kind of an old book way. Old Bibles mm-hmm. were done that way, where there's an image in the middle and then the text kind of text flows, if we know this from desktop publishing, around the image, as it does in the Secret Teachings. So within that are these, there's over 200 black and white, they're either line drawings or reproductions from, woodcuts or, metal engravings or things mm-hmm. like that. Many of them going back, hundreds of years, thousands
yep.
of years. And that's another level. You can look at those images, and there's an egg with a snake wrapped around it, this Orphic egg. And wow, that's what does that mean to you? So there's another way to look at these black and white images. And then the third level of approaching the material is reading the text in each of mm-hmm. the chapters, and each one plays a different role. It acts upon you differently. And sometimes the same subjects will be reflected in the text as they are in the color picture or in the inline drawing, but you're revisiting it in a different way. So already you have this threefold interface with the book. So your body and your mind and your eyes are going to be affected, on different levels in different ways with this book. So it's very much a magic book, but it really has everything to do with how it plays in you. And finally he goes on to say that that it's like a door. It is a door opening up into, say, a temple of wisdom. And he says within it is contained a wealth of imagery, a wealth of mysteries, designs, and figures. and you have wandered therein. So opening the book is like entering this sanctuary. You might say to yourself, and he says, quote, I wish I had a guide to tell me what these things mean. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how many times I've heard that from people with the secret teachings, like, you know, wow, this is great. It was a trippy image. I go, what does it mean? You know, what do I do with the snake wrapped around
me? Yeah, exactly. You know?
And he finishes this by saying, this is his, you know, final statement regarding the book. So I wish I had a guide to tell me what these things mean. And you will find your guide to be your own rational soul.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's kind of the scary part about it, is that, you know, yes, you have, you know, this door, and yes, you have this menu, this smorgasbord of imagery and things, but we all must travel this alone. Now, we can talk about it, and we can have book studies and exchange information, which is really great, but, you know, when it comes down to it, it's really, you know, what is that working on you, in your soul?
Exactly.
And let that speak to you, and oh, maybe some of it you don't like, and maybe this you don't disagree with. Well, fine, that's your rational soul. And if you look at the dedication of the original 1928 book, which I think made it in the subsequent reprints, it is dedicated to the rational soul of the world.
Oh, fantastic. Pulls it completely full circle. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's huge.
Your own rational soul, if you are reading the book.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I think rational collective soul as well, the kind of self with a capital S, or the absolute. And so speaking of that, I want to kind of get back real quick again to that point of the idea of having one central idea that's repeated 45 different times. That was a very valuable sort of clue or secret that he's giving out. When I'm reading, I try to keep that in mind, and I try to look for that. And I think that if the listener can keep that in mind while reading this, look for the one story in all of these chapters that will elucidate something very important for you. And we may or may not come to the same conclusion as to what the one story is, but it'll tell us something very great about ourselves. Would you agree with that?
Well, think of the hero. I would. And you can even think of the hero's journey. If a lot of people seem to be familiar mm-hmm. with it. If not, it's a Joseph Campbell monomyth that most, you know, myths, and it very well plays into most movies, at least successful movies today, follow this theme of initiation or departure, initiation and return, this hero's journey, the story of the hero with 1,000 faces.
Sure.
So maybe Top Gun and Sound of Music seem like very different movies, but in essence, there's this template,
the archetypal journey. The archetype is in there, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That's a
So, like, what that is to mythology, think of that of something similar in a way to the ancient wisdom. What's the monomyth? What's the single story
in each
that
of
gets
those,
repeated
yeah.
in different ways?
And that brings a great deal of light, I think, to the subject matter when you're searching in that fashion. Another thing.
Well, it's easy to get lost in all this complex and arcane imagery.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
And you can kind of get a little bit to find underneath it all. There's a common thread.
Well, the two, another suggestion, and he makes this himself in this document that we're referencing, which, by the way, is called Remarks on Mr. Hall's Book. He talks about, you know, when you approach the book, really says to begin from the beginning. In other words, start at the very beginning of the book, read the introduction, read the preface, read all of the front matter in the book before you jump right into the work. And he essentially will tell you how to approach the work, not as clearly as we've just elucidated, but he'll hint at what you need to look for and so on. Because like you said, it can be an intimidating book, and it is an encyclopedia. So sometimes it's, you know, be like sitting down to read an old Encyclopedia Britannica or something, just pick up a volume and start reading it from the beginning. It seems a little bit odd to do that, or to read a dictionary, but it's not like that. When you read it, you can read it from front to back, or you can take sections that you like. It just like you said, you know, if something sticks out particularly to you, some symbolism of a particular chapter holds your interest, start with that. But do start with that material at the beginning, the preface, the introduction, and thinking about the one story. I think that's a good way to frame approaching the book for a first-time reader. Would you agree?
I wouldn't. That's very well put.
Thanks. Thanks. All right. So let's talk a little bit then about today. What's the importance of the book today?
Okay.
Why is it still important? Why are people still reading this book? Why is Manly Hall still, you know, hugely popular on YouTube? What's the deal with that? Let's speak about that a little bit.
Well, the purpose or the reason, the why having it now, why is it important now, is the same reason why it was important in 1928 to publish it in the first place. The same reason why these ancient traditions and mystery schools were developed thousands of years ago. It is to serve a need that humankind, throughout time, in different civilizations and different movements of consciousness, technology, and social standings, however we find ourselves, we have a tendency as a culture, as a creature, to get lost in the world. And this is a theme of most of the great religions, that this world of Maya, of illusion, or of material things, or the profane or the mundane earthly existence.
So just the day-to-day living, the stresses, the money-making, all of that stuff, right?
Yeah, and we lose touch not only with what the world is all about, that there's this whole other invisible landscape of archetypes and ideas and ideals and ethics and morals and culture, that we lose sight of that. But we have also, and I think this is where the book really gets to, and this is why he placed such an emphasis on the personal, reader, the aspect that this is your soul, that it has to be involved with this stuff, is that we have also lost sight of who we are as human beings. We've become enamored in the world and in the material world, and we've sort of rejected, with science and other things, the spirit world or superstition, or that, well, that's just invisible, or that's faith, or, you can't prove that type. And then this becomes important, what's in front of, and yes, it is important, but we're talking about a balance, that it becomes out of balance, where it becomes, heavy with the material things. Just as that has happened with the world around us, the material kind of versus the spiritual, we've also done the same thing to ourselves. We have, our human creature, this being, this thing that walks around and eats and has appetites and urges and does things. That needs to be maintained. But there's so much more to us.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The great traditions always teach that we have this connection to a higher source, whether it's, inner wisdom, the inner Buddha nature, the Christ in you.
That higher self within us. Yeah.
Your higher power from alcohol addiction recovery. It's an incredibly common theme, but these traditions and the old mystery schools were, they were really built to help us, stay in tune with it. Now, it's not for everybody at every stage in their life, but the way this book is and the way the ancient wisdom is, you can't really, it would be like learning math. If you're in grade school learning long division, you're not going to get harmed by differential calculus or trigonometry. Mm-hmm. You could try it. It's probably not going to work for you because you need algebra, you need some things. To learn before you get there. So if you're, playing out of your league or in over your head or something, it's just not going to be effective.
Yeah.
So you're not going to mess yourself up. You're not going to mess up the world. But use what you can at whatever level. And then each level gives you more knowledge, more of a foundation from which to approach more refined or, higher, maybe more
absolutely,
complex.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what's interesting about that too, is speaking of the book, I mean, if you follow it in a sequential order and you take the time and you take it slowly, it gives you the tools to approach those higher mysteries. And I think you said this, or someone said this, that it's like that the secret teachings is like a mystery school in a book. Was it you that said that, or was it in one of the readings?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm going to quote you on that because it's genius. A mystery school in a book. I think that's just beautiful. So You know, and speaking of that, speaking of the mystery schools, I think that another thing that he wanted to do with this book was to preserve that golden chain, that golden thread, which he believed existed. You know, many people believe that behind all of the religions and the spiritual speculations and all the different movements and symbols and so on, that at one time there was a sort of a mono religion, speaking of a mono myth, that there was a secret and hidden wisdom that existed that was sort of passed on to initiates and to different individuals. And that, you know, each of these different schools of thought, these different movements and so on through history are actually an heir to that teaching. And that this book is a compendium that presents and preserves that golden thread, that golden chain, in each of these different approaches. Do you see that in there? Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I do. That's great. And it's to reintroduce you.
Yeah.
Like reintroduce your soul. Cause there's probably part of you and me that kind of already knows that.
Yeah.
Or has some conscious, not quite conscious to our daily mind, but on some level of our consciousness, we are connected to that. That's why, you know, we see a movie.
Yeah, exactly.
By it, because we see ourselves in that. It touches something.
And it's opening.
I saw Field of Dreams, the movie, and I was like, you know, I don't want to watch a baseball movie. I'm sure about baseball. Well, it was all about baseball, but nothing to do with baseball.
Just like Rocky. Okay, Rocky has nothing to do with boxing. It's not. I don't even know how they call it a sports movie. I just watched it again the other night. I'm like, the fight at the end of the movie is like 9 minutes long or something. That's the boxing phase, and then a little portion at the beginning. Then the rest of it's just, you know, one man's journey to himself. At any rate,
yeah, he's in the ring boxing his own soul, his own.
No, exactly.
You know, being, exactly. Fighting for, you know, to go the distance.
He didn't even want to win. It's such a genius movie. So, but you're right. And that's a good point because, I mean, you know, today we have the idea that a child is born, you know, as they say, tabula rasa, a blank slate. That's sort of the materialistic idea. And Jung and all of these philosophers of the past, many different traditions and so on would say, no, we come in with seeds of things within us already, with different propensities and different ideas and sort of archetypal wisdom that just has to be activated. And I think that was Plato's idea that knowledge was something that just had to be reactivated in essence. It was already in there. It wasn't something to be put in. It was something that was there that needed to be sort of uncovered. It was from Plato, right?
Well, and I think even the etymology of the word, you know, educate, educare, is, you know, to draw out.
Very good.
Doesn't mean to pull in.
To draw out.
To draw out. And that's the role of the teacher. And that's really the role of this book in the mystery schools is to bring something out in you. Yes, you need to be exposed to this. Yes, you need to see the awesome images and read the fantastic tales. But you have to experience something
within yourself, within. Right?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, that it has to work on you in some way. I mean, you know, I'll just go back to movies. We can leave a movie theater and be moved.
Sure.
In 2 hours. And you know it's Hollywood actors and special effects.
But something shifted.
Archetypally, something touched you, and it can be life-changing, and that movie can be a touchstone for your philosophy of life that you always go back on. Maybe a movie like Casablanca, here's somebody, again, like, you know, Rocky, somebody wrestling with his soul. It's a movie about redemption. It's World War II in the bar. But the real battle is going on inside this guy's soul. And he's fighting for it. And at the end, when, you know, Laszlo and Ilsa are going to get on the plane and he, you know, self-sacrifices his ticket out of Casablanca, Laszlo turns to him and says, "Welcome back to the fight, Rick. This time I know our side is going to win." And I'll be damned if that doesn't bring me to tears every time I'm talking about it. Like, oh my God.
That's a beautiful scene.
But it's because he's got back to the fight. He got back on track. He got in tune with the infinite. And that's what the secret teachings and this perpetuation and preservation. And the the promulgation, yeah. I guess I'm looking for a word, but that we're talking about this now.
Yeah, yeah.
And someone's going to listen on the podcast, and there's, you know, people already buying the book and yeah. you know, looking at it online and reading it. And we are carrying the lamp. We are passing the baton of wisdom, and it's up to us now in this
yeah.
moment to get involved
exactly.
with this, you know, the mystery information
exactly.
and to have it work on our own souls. Then it shows
up
in our lives and our works, but we're doing the
yeah,
work too
exactly.
by really talking about this book, and we're keeping this alive. We are reading his remarks from 91 years ago so that they can be heard again today, and 100 years from now, someone's going to be
exactly
100 years later.
I completely
later.
Agree.
This, and, but we are doing that today,
and that's the yeah
where we are.
And you are a gentleman and a scholar, my friend. You did a wonderful job presenting the material. Thank you so much.
And about
well,
the gentleman part, of it. I'll take the scholar.
And so with that, I mean, we'll wrap it up a little, you know, at the end
okay.
here. But approach this book and. You know, let it be a mystery school for you. You know, we've given you some hints about how you can approach this book in an intelligent and, you know, a productive way. The Secret Teachings of All Ages, Manly P. Hall's classic work. So May 28th is going to be Tuesday. So you'll be listening to this on Sunday, May 26th. We do these in a week in advance. So I say to you on Tuesday, you know, I'm projecting into your future, Secret Teachings Day. Happy Secret Teachings Day. That's what
great.
We're going to call it. And so each year we'll go ahead and do something special before May 28th to celebrate this important and life-changing for me and for you as well, I know, book. And I know that the readers,
definitely.
If they're able to approach it in the same way that we have, will find the same kind of things that we have. It really is a life-altering book if you allow it to work on your inner life. So thank you again, Chris. You did a spectacular job. I want to thank all of our listeners and all of our new supporters to the podcast. And please, if you get something out of this, you know, feel free to contribute whatever you can to keep us, you know, to keep us on this path of doing this work each week. If you can contribute a little something, you know, a few dollars, $5, $10 a month, whatever,
okay.
There is an option. To be able to do that through Anchor, and we appreciate those who have supported the show. We will be back next week. We have a new show every Sunday. I'm your host, Jason Napolitano, and I have Chris Sheridan on the line. Thank you again, Chris. Chris, your book is The Spirit in the Sky, and that's available on Amazon.com. My book is I forgot the name of my book all of a sudden. How do you like that?
If you can worry.
If you can worry, you can meditate. Or, in other words, if you can forget, you can meditate as well, apparently. So
you have achieved
I have
no
achieved
mind.
Zen, no mind. All right. Thanks again, and goodbye, and God bless.
Thank you.